So if I can do bookkeeping questions first.
Sure.
First name?
Charles.
Last name?
Collins.
C-O-L-L-I-N-S?
Correct.
And date of birth, if I may be so bold.
5-3-5-3-42.
Okay. And place of birth?
In a farm, on a farm about a mile and a half north of Gailton, Colorado. So rural Weld County. My mother thought that hospitals allowed newborns to lose weight, so I was born in the farmhouse.
She's probably right. There's a lot. I actually talked to somebody recently who went to Mexico to look at midwifery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you have problems, you want to be in a hospital. Yeah, if you don't have problems, you're actually way better off not being in a hospital.
You do expose the child to potential for lots of infection and things like that. And the early attention and the hands-on and the constant... You know, a newborn with a family. Everyone's there, and a lot of holding and touching, I guess.
Yeah. Your role in the Bracero program?
Number one, because I had learned field Spanish before, I served on our farm and some of the adjacent farms as an unofficial interpreter. I was a banker for them. They would not want to take time off from work, and they would give me letters written, and they would endorse the checks. I would take them to the bank and cash them. Take them to get groceries. Days off, we'd go hunting. When they were on the farm, they were a source of great fascination to me, and I'd spend as much time with them as I could.
Now, what years would you say you're...
The key years were when I was in high school, so we're talking about, let's say, 57 to 60.
And then your dad or your parents owned a farm?
Yes, yes. We had a farm here in Weld County and raised, in addition to beets... beans, cucumbers. It was very much a family farm.
Okay, so switching over to that immediately.
Okay.
The farm was in Weld County.
Yes.
And what crops did you all grow?
If you want the whole list,
I do actually.
Okay.
I'm reading one of the things that. It's really interesting. As one does history, one realizes the mistakes that you've been making in the past. And as I was talking to this group of farmers today, they don't deal with historians a lot, so they were kind of nervous about talking to me. And I was pointing out to them, I'm the chair of the Division of Work and Industry where we do agriculture, and I was pointing out that we don't actually have anything in our collection about farming beets, sugar beets. It is not represented in the national collections.
Let me tell you.
And they were horrified by that.
Yes,
I mean, I was
yes.
chagrined by it because it's not exactly a small part of American farming.
It's not.
But it's totally not represented. If you look at the literature, there's very little in terms of scholarly works done on the subject. So, you know, the more that we can, the more that white gold...
This is written by a local Mexican gentleman that grew up in the Spanish colony, so-called, here in Greeley.
And I've heard about Peggy Ford.
Yes, she's a wonderful resource. But Gabe, as he once said to me, I didn't pay much attention in school, and so I write the way I speak, and Peggy Ford invested hundreds of hours in editing, but you'll still see that it's, from an academic point of view, it's not well written, but it has probably information that you will not find anywhere else.
Oh, this is huge.
And this was not the Bracero settlement at all. In fact, this was many of the early folks were recruited out of New Mexico, out of Texas, some out of Mexico, and...
I just got photographs.
If you... desire a copy, the place to go is the Municipal Museum and talk to Peggy Ford. And
I'm definitely going to make it
okay.
down there. I've got to get
yes.
that.
She is a... The newspaper files that they have
right.
are incredible. I mean, they've had volunteers and others clipping newspaper articles by topic for years.
Excellent. Oh, yeah. That's superb. So coming back
to the farm,
your family farm.
Okay, let's just run down the list. Typical year, we would have sugar beets, kennel beans, always some alfalfa, corn, by all means, both silage corn and shell corn. So one, of course, you cut the entire stalk and you feed it directly to cattle, mm-hmm. which used to mystify I almost use the term nationals. If you talk to farmers around here, they use the term national, a Mexican national, to distinguish those that came in temporarily from resident Mexicans. So they say, oh, the nationals. They seldom would use the term bracero, a farmer.
They were only used to the nationals were only used to shell corn?
No. What I was going to say is they were always very interested in how we did things here. And so I have three or four of them in the pickup one day, and we're driving down the road, and they smell a silage pit. So silage corn is cut, the complete stalk and ear, chopped up and put in a pit in the ground or an upright pit. Begins to ferment a little mm-hmm. bit, and they said, "Qué huele?" You know, what smells? And come on, showed them. And they said, and I said, "The cattle love it." Oh, and showed them about that, and they just thought that was really interesting. There was a lot of idea and technology transfer that occurred in this time as well. So, but we would have corn, two kinds. One we'd cut for the cattle, and then the other you would simply shell the ear,
right.
and that also is used for animal feed, but differently.
Right. Now, it's interesting you talk about technology transfer, because that was one of the things that when the program was first, the Bracero program was first originated, was an end, a hope for this goal. Do you think that many Braceros did learn from the experience?
I can only speak about the context I had, but I printed this if you want. I like to write stories, so I retain some memories, and here are examples of technology transfer, and they're mentioned in here.
That's super. Is it possible to actually get an electronic version of this?
Yes, it is.
If you don't mind.
It is. I've got it here, and I will simply make it an attachment and send it to you.
Perfect.
By the way, I am the technological dinosaur in our department, so I've been dragged kicking and screaming, and it's a wonderful thing, except
it's like
right now.
A pretty big computer setup.
Well, yeah. Right now that one needs replaced, but yes, it's addictive. Back to your question, I'm sorry. Two kinds of corn, cucumbers at times.
Huh. Everybody keeps saying cucumbers rather than, other people have been saying pickles.
Yeah, pickles.
And you said cucumbers.
We grow pickles. Well, that's after the processing, right?
Right.
But the farmer ease is, yeah, I've got 3 acres of pickles. Yeah.
So it was really cucumbers exclusively for
and
pickling.
Yes, exactly. Not for fresh use, but for pickling.
Now, how are all these, you were planning, in terms of your acreage, you were splitting things up. How big was the farm?
The farm is about 200 acres.
Wow, that's a pretty big farm.
How long? It began as 160. And then my father were able to, there were some rough years and some pretty good years,
yeah.
and able to buy a small adjacent farm and work them together, grade them together, so about 200 acres. Out of that, I imagine that on average we might have had, and this is pretty small scale anymore, we might have had 40 acres of beets, 30 or 40 acres of beets. Large acreage would be to corn. Because we fed some cattle over the winter. You always needed some alfalfa. The pickles/cucumbers never were more than 3 or 4 acres, because they had to be picked every other day. And so labor was always an issue there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The beets were very labor intensive at several stages.
Mm-hmm.
corn was almost completely mechanized, even back in the 50s. And so.
When did your dad start farming? When did he buy the farm?
That farm he bought, in fact, I was born about 2 months after they moved on the farm, so 1942 he bought that, and kept it until his retirement, which he's deceased now, but he probably retired about because when he sold that farm, he told me, he looked me in the eye and he said, "This is the first time in 39 years I've not slept in my own bed." Huh. So he had it for 39 years.
Wow.
And then he bought a smaller farm.
No.
He couldn't retire. And then he sold that, and he was a ditch rider, and my mother died of all this stuff that you don't need to know. But
no, actually, I'm really interested. The tangents are often the most important kind of thing. Really,
and he finally returned to the state, his birth state of Georgia, and lived out the remainder of his life, remarried after my mother died here.
Huh. So he actually sort of learned the trade in farming in Georgia, and then moved to Colorado?
Learned nothing about farming here from Georgia. He came out and he said he arrived in Eaton, Colorado on a March day and the snow was blowing horizontally. He said, "I was wearing a seersucker suit." He said, "If I'd had enough money, I would have gotten right back on that train." But he got a room in the hotel there, and he said the next day there was a knock on the door. In a fellow county, he said, "I heard there was a green Georgian." There was quite a Georgia migration to this area earlier. Hmm. And a former Georgian gave him a job on the farm, and he learned by working on farms there. Then he rented for a while and then finally bought.
Huh. So that was in the 30s?
He chose 1929 to come to Colorado. You know, the Depression and things.
But he wrote out the Depression.
Yeah, but he was working. He and my mother used to say, "Had you lived through the Depression," usually when I was doing something that, you know, they thought was not very wise. He said during the Depression he was renting land and farming, had a cow, some pigs. He said, "We were actually saving a little bit of money because we basically fed ourselves."
Right.
We weren't dependent upon wage. And he said, yeah. It wasn't grand, but we made it through that all right.
Yeah. Huh.
But he always retained that memory, and the boys would be doing something. He'd say, "Now, if you'd lived through the Depression, you'd know how to use something used rather than something new."
So by 42, he had enough money that he could actually buy.
By 42, he could make
acres.
A down payment on a rundown farm. Yeah.
Huh, that's interesting. Now, When did you all start employing braceros? Or I guess I should say, when did you start employing farmhands?
Well, not too much employed at first, because there were three boys. I'm the baby. Mm-hmm. And so my two older brothers provide a lot of labor. But I do recall my father saying that the little farmhouse that they moved into had no basement. And so it must have been by 1944, 45, when the beatwork was done. He said he hired the nationals to help dig a partial basement under an existing house. And he said they were happy to have the extra work. And he said the thing he remembered back in the mid-40s, he said some were still wearing the traditional Mexican hat, the big hat. And he said, those things were hand-woven, apparently. He said, you could stand on the crown and it wouldn't cave in. He said, those Mexicans would be out in the field working, and there were a few cottontail rabbits. Anything that provided protein, I mean, they were after. I talk about it there. And he said, that hat, he said, you could knock a rabbit unconscious with it. And
wow.
This is silly stuff, but you're making memories come back.
How interesting. So they were actually...
In the 40s.
They were interested in hunting and providing, adding to their, not having to buy everything.
Sure.
Now, did he employ, as soon as the Bracero program started, do you think he employed Braceros?
I think very early on, yes. Because, as I say, I was only a couple of years old and they were digging that basement and already he had Braceros.
Now, do you know how he actually obtained Braceros? Did he do it or was it through some intermediary?
I'm sure that the Great Western Sugar Company at the time here made provision because in North Greeley there was a location where the buses would bring the braceros in, and then the farmers would go in and get their a number of workers. And then one of my jobs later on was when their contract was up, I would drive them back in. And
how long did those contracts generally last?
It seems to me, and again, they were here typically 2 to 3 months. Because if you think about the beets, when the beets get to be about, 2 inches high, 2.5 inches mm-hmm. high, the first work, they thinned them. And the way they planted beets back then, they planted the seed very densely in order to have enough crop. And then they'd come in and with the hose they would block them or they would thin them. So that might take them with our amount of beets, that might take them 2 to 3 weeks. By the end of that, the beets that they had started with, or they might have to wait a week or two, do something else, then they'd come back the second time and go through and take out any weeds. In the meantime, we would have gone through with a tractor to cultivate them as well. Mm-hmm. And,
so you were using a tractor from the get-go?
Oh, yes, yeah.
You never did horses or mules?
I'm too young. I don't often get to say that. Huh. But it was always tractors on that farm up there. My right. father, when he first started here, worked with horses some, but no, tractors.
So in terms of the time, when would you plow, fall or spring?
You don't want to lessen it. Where we lived, the soil was light and sandy. Mm-hmm. And so we'd always plow in the springtime, because if you plowed in the fall and left all that bare ground, the winter wind would blow the sand and dust around. So we'd plow as soon as the frost got out. So you could probably start plowing maybe late March, depending upon the year, into April.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd have to go over that ground 3 or 4 times to get a good seed bed, get it nice and compacted and level, because we were irrigating with flood irrigation, gravity irrigation, right. and you had to have the field fairly smooth. You plant the beets.
Actually, you would compact and then you'd make furrows? Or
you would compact and you'd have it nice and smooth, and then as you planted it, you would leave some small ditches in there. You were hoping, praying usually, that shortly after you planted, you'd get a rain, which seldom came. Then you might have to go back, and although the beets had not come up, try to follow those marks. It was called blind ditching, and hope you weren't digging out the seed. Irrigate that. Once they got some moisture, they came up pretty rapidly.
So about when would you put the seeds in?
Oh, we'd be planting in April.
April?
Yeah, yeah.
And then they'd come up sort of mid-April?
Yeah, if you had some moisture, you know, within 2 weeks, you've got little beets coming up. And you wanted them to... Then you wanted, before they came in to thin them, you cultivated them the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And you cultivated at a very low speed, and you used some discs... So it ended up leaving a band of undisturbed earth, hopefully no wider than that, with beets down the middle.
Mm-hmm. About 3 inches, 4 inches?
More like two.
2 inches.
If you could hold it on the row, and then they came through.
Careful tractor driving.
You had to go very, very slowly. I was doing that one time, and in the dirt, I saw a shape go by, and I stopped the tractor, and I got up, and I started digging there. And I found a nice Indian arrowhead, but I'd been going slowly enough to see it go by, and it took me a moment, and I'd covered it, and I got down. And of course, my father would probably, if he'd been here, say, "What's holding up the work here?" He caught me one time because I hadn't gotten enough sleep the night before, and I was cultivating, and I was getting drowsy right after lunch. So I shut the tractor down, and I went over in it by the ditch bank, and pretty soon I heard my name being called. I thought, he said, "You all right?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "I was a little drowsy. I thought I'd just take a few minutes nap here." He said, well, that's better than cultivator blight, which was the farmer's term for cutting out the beets. But cultivate, they'd come through and thin them.
Now, the thinning you would do, or
they would do.
So that's the Proceros are on the scene by then?
Yes, they are. Absolutely.
So they arrive about when?
Well, they would probably be here, if things worked out, you'd hope they were here in April. Certainly by May.
Mm-hmm. And how did they get paid? Are they getting paid by the hour or by the acre or by some other means?
I must confess ignorance. I do not know. I do not know. I know that when they were employing non-bracero labor, the farmer and the worker would negotiate. And very often the workers would want to work by the hour, and the farmer would want to pay them by the acre.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't. I don't remember the numbers. I was a kid, and so you know, Dad took care of that. And
the braceros would do the thinning.
The thinning.
Now, did they use in this area? Did they use short handle hoes or regular hoes?
They did early on, but my recollection is all of long handled hoes. The issue was you've got this strip of soil that's kind of elevated because you've cut it away.
Right.
And not only do you want them to leave a beet about every 12 inches, because then you'll get maximum growth per beet, but also there was problems with doubles, they were called, when you planted so thickly the seed, which, by the way, they don't do anymore, you'd have two plants very close together. So farmers wanted them either to use a short-handled hoe, because you can get closer and not cut them both out,
right?
Or they wanted them to, quote, pick the doubles. So you would hoe, and then if they were two very close together, you'd pull one out, hopefully pulling out the weaker looking and leaving the stronger.
Right.
But when I was with the braceros, and I remember that part by the time I was in middle school, high school, our farm, we had long-handled hoes. I still have a short-handled hoe at home.
And, do you really?
Yeah, and I have a long-handled a beet knife. I can just remember... I must have been, let's see, I would have been in first grade in 1948, and they were still pulling and topping beets by hand, a few were topping by hand with the knives. And then, of course, the mechanization came in.
I've actually never seen a beet knife, much less.
Ah.
We have a short-handle hoe in the collection, but we have nothing, although I think it was used in lettuce. We don't have anything in the collections related to
I can get you one if you want.
Would love. That would be fabulous.
Okay,
that
I'll do it.
Great.
Yeah, it's got the hook on the end, and because before the beet toppers, they would come through with a beet puller, and it would loosen the beet. Then one crew would come through, and you grab them by the tops, and you throw them over in kind of a row. Then the crew comes back, and it has a hook on it, so. You're able to stand mm-hmm. and reach out with a knife and hook the beet and pull it up, grab it by the root, cut the top off, and toss it over.
Oh,
into
so it has
it.
A fairly long handle.
The beet knife is probably 14, 15 inches long, that much wood on it, and at the very tip of the blade is this, not a hook, but a point. And yeah.
And you could just stab it.
You could pick it up, and so you didn't have to bend over and pick every one of them up.
So it's did people complain about the short handle hose, or... I know that was a point of argument in the Southwest, but I don't know what it was like up here.
Sure. I'm confident they did, because we're talking about long days in a field, backbreaking to lead over that time. Some were incredible. I mean, they would start at a row, and you might see them, this row might be half a mile long. And you might see them a couple times stand up like that. My perception, my discussions with them, they were so happy to have work. Because, as I understand, at least technically, the allocation of the number of permits per Mexican state was related to the unemployment in those states. And Yeah.
Like people actually paid bribes to.
Oh yes, they did.
To be able to come Norte.
Don Martin, I got to know this slightly older bracero, because he was here on a neighboring farm, and I talked to him and things. And some of the others, the youngers, would call him Don, a term of respect, Don Martin. When we were talking one day, he said, when I came to the inspection, and he puffed out his chest, they looked at me and they said, you're too old. And I said, I am not too old to work. I can work as much as anyone. And he said, they wanted to take money from me, but I told them they had to let me come. I saw him the year after, and I saw him in the neighbor's field. And I stopped, and I went walking out there, and dropped his hoe and came running, gave me a big abrazo. Don Martin was back. And so he was there 2 years in a row. Huh. That was fairly rare to see the same person
the
a
same
couple
people.
Years in a row. Yeah. But, yeah, he said that very often they wanted una mordida to get across the border to be selected.
So did you work in the fields with him?
I was in the field. I did not sand beach because I was usually on a tractor or I was irrigating. Spent a lot of time with them. I spent more time with the braceros during a typical early summer day than I did with my family. My father had hired a fellow named Fabian Garcia, who was born in southern Texas, and he worked for the family for a number of years. He was the, quote, hired man. And he spoke almost no English. And so I remember when my father hired him, he told me, you go work with Fabian. He said, because I'm too old to learn another language. You learn the language. And I learned the most mongrelized field Spanish. And then when I went to school and finally decided, okay, I'll get a bachelor's in Spanish. Some of my professors were just scratching their heads. They said, what? I said, that's what they say here. No. Yeah, that's what they say here. And so a lot of what are called pochismos and slang. But the people that I learned from had very little education, formal education. So when I learned from Fabian, and then the braceros came, it was, we had no problem understanding one another. And that was good.
Oh, interesting. Now, Fabian was a local.
He lived here much of his adult life, but he'd been born in southern Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And in that environment, had never found a great need to learn English. He knew farming. He knew tractor work. He was
right.
A really good worker. And the only time that he would burst into, as I mentioned there, he would burst into a torrent of English was to swear when something happened, and mash his hand or something.
Yeah.
And then he'd use a mixture.
Oh, that's great. Now, how big a crew, how many braceros would you all generally have?
Typically, five or six seemed to be the number.
And where did they actually live?
We had a, quote, labor house.
Mm-hmm.
It was a three-room house. I remember it began as a two-room house, and my father had another larger room added onto it, and it was on the edge of our yard. That's where they lived during their time of employment. Yeah.
Which was, you said, was like about 2 months?
It'd be 2 to 3 months,
two
yeah.
2 to 3 months.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would take them all the way up through the harvest?
That would take them through the harvest in the later years when they had to do the hand topping of the beets. As time and technology progressed, it got to the point where they were doing the thinning and probably two hoeings of the beets.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, everything became more and more mechanized. The beet toppers came in, and so they weren't needed for that. In some cases, they would pick pickles, cucumbers.
Okay. Oh.
Uh-huh. But most of the other crops that we had, the beans, the barley, the alfalfa, things like that, were mechanized to the point that our family could take care
right.
of it.
So early on, they would come in for the thinning, then they would do two hoeings. And at that point, there's sort of some downtime?
Or they would be working at other things.
Like the cucumbers or potatoes.
The cucumbers, or prior to the mechanization, a lot of stacking of hay.
Ah,
when hay was stacked
right.
loosely, they might be hoeing the pinto beans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They didn't thin those, but they would simply go through and get the weeds out.
Right.
Especially if it was a difficult year and you didn't feel like you got enough out with the cultivator. And some weeds always insist on growing right next to the...
Of course.
But, yeah.
Now, did they also run the tractors and that kind of stuff?
Usually not. Some would, if you invited them to do something like that, say, no, I don't know that. A few would, and a few... One of the things that used to impress me, if they were using a piece of equipment, incredibly careful with it. And things. Mm. But many had come from farm backgrounds, but this brought up the point. One time I went out and they were starting the hoeing. They had thinned and they were starting the hoeing. And they had hoed for a while, and my father had gone by, and he said, "You need to go tell those guys," said, "they're leaving the corn in the beets." And so I went and I said, you need to chop that corn out, because corn had been in the field the year before.
Right.
And it come up voluntarily.
Sure.
And I said to them, you need to cut the corn. No, pero es bueno. Leave the corn there because it's good. Corn is a good crop. And the system was that different. They did not see an issue with having some corn growing in a beet field. And, of course, the farmers here, it was clear cultivation and one crop.
Yeah.
And I remember that, saying, no, but the corn is good. No, you have to take it out.
Now, how involved was the Great Western in sort of dictating your agricultural practice?
I'm not sure when it began, but there were allotments in terms of acreage per farm.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I should have paid more attention. My father used to say that. You should have paid more attention.
Yes.
But in terms of getting the beet seed, I believe that there was an authorized beet seed that they wanted grown, and so you'd obtain your beet seed from them. They were the ones that decided when the beet dump would open. This was the location to which you hauled the beets. There, you dump them into a large... combination kind of sorter and conveyor. The dirt would be knocked out of some of the beets. They'd be put in a large pile. That's where they would take a sample of your beets and determine the sugar content, mm-hmm. because pay was based upon sugar content. That's where you got the tares back from your load, dirt and things that had been sorted out in this process. So they determined when the dump would open, and so that dictated the start of harvest.
Right. Now, did they actually do field inspections to sort of intermediate?
Yes. There was a field man. Yeah. I remember Mr. Schroeder was the field man for a number of years. And obviously, I don't know what his take on the issue was, but he seemed very pro-farmer. And he was someone who knew about beets, knew about beet disease, could represent the farmer to the company. But again, I don't know where he felt his allegiance was, but I can remember a couple of field men who served in that capacity for years on end.
So almost like the Agricultural Extension Service.
Yeah.
Except a corporate
specifically
extension.
To beets, yeah.
Now, did you get Agricultural Extension Service government people too?
You could do that. Although I think most farmers... bless their hearts, felt like they probably knew more about this than some college-educated expert, except for this field man who had grown up with this kind of practice.
Huh. So where do you think your dad really picked up his knowledge?
Clearly that man that knocked on his hotel door and said, "Hey, you need a job?" was a small farmer, small in terms of a family farm. And so... I do not doubt at all that my father not only operated some equipment in the beets, but given that time, that was 1929-30, probably ended up in the field with a hoe in his hand, thinning and, yeah.
Right. It's a great way to learn.
Yeah. On-the-job training.
Yeah, on-the-job training. So, going back to when the braceros were actually picked up, how did that really work? You said there was like a hiring hall in town?
There was a word would come out to Dad that, okay, your workers will be here on this day.
Had he placed an order earlier for a number of individuals?
I'm sure he had told them about how many beats you're going to have and how many he thought he needed. And I don't know if he got that many or more or less, but
right.
It always seemed to be about the same number.
Mm-hmm. And so word would come that they're coming into town?
Yes, yes. You need to be here on Tuesday.
And then you would just drive down in the truck and pick them up?
We'd come down in the car and pick them up. Usually stop by someplace on the way home so they could get some groceries.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that my father thought that there were a couple stores that would overcharge. Hmm. And so he would not take them there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a small country store a couple miles from our farm, and we would go there. And they would get their basics, take them to the house, show them where everything was. Beds and bedding were there. They had to carry their water a short distance. My father had a line extended down next to the house. See if there's anything, any questions they had, anything they needed, try to get them settled in. But they wanted to start working as soon as they could. They were here with a real focus, a real goal.
A mission to work.
Yes. While we looked at a day of rain as a real blessing, for them it was a day without working. But I liked those days because I would go down and they'd be making tortillas, big stacks of tortillas I talk about in there. And I would be there, and they'd be teaching me words, and I'd be eating tortillas down in the labor house.
So were your parents supportive of you hanging with them, or were they concerned about that?
My parents said, don't be a pest. Don't be in the way. But they saw me learning things, and that worked out well. Their concern was, don't be down there bothering them. They need to rest or they need to whatever. And we had a great time.
Do you think in general, were your parents different, or do you think that in general was the community fairly receptive to the braceros?
Understanding the need for labor, understanding the importance of beats.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases making, whether they were justified or not, rather insidious comparisons about how good the bracero workers were versus people who lived here all the time. That comparison was often made, and sometimes unjustly, I think. But the other thing was, in terms of a farmer hiring labor, you hire 6 adult males. They're all workers.
Right.
But if you hire a family, then you need to provide housing for the entire group, and not all are workers, although often the small children work too.
So that was the other way that labor people would hire families to provide labor?
There, in my vivid recollection, springtime in Weld County was marked by the arrival of out-of-state trucks hauling groups of people in to work. They came from Texas, they came from New Mexico, but especially Texas. You'd see them coming in. It was in some places, it's when the swallows arrive, you know what time of the year it is. Here, when the trucks began coming in. And, for example, there was a concern because it would be a family and they'd have small children. And irrigation ditches going by were a concern for anyone. The children might fall in there because the parents are out working in the field. But when you got 6 adult males whose entire focus was working, and frankly, if they wanted to go someplace, either they had to get a ride with us or they had to walk. And we were out in the county, so it was work.
How often did you take them into town?
When they needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They didn't want to go to town very often because that meant not working. So as I mentioned before, they would send me with their checks.
So they would prefer to have you as an emissary to do the business?
I guess after a period of time, as we spent time together, and they would say, well, I would show up. In fact, sometimes I would be there because I would be able to write their names, since right. My father might not understand exactly how to spell that name. And I would help write the checks. And then they would already have a letter written and the envelope addressed. They'd give me the check. They'd say, keep a little for yourself. They worked too hard.
So
and I would go to the bank with hundreds of dollars, purchase money orders. They would have endorsed them.
So you would your dad would write a check to them, and then they would cash the check.
They would endorse it. I would take it to the bank and cash it.
Right.
And purchase a money order.
Right.
Because they wouldn't. Yeah. You wouldn't send a check.
Cash, right.
You'd want to send cash. And they knew about money orders. They would and bring them the receipt back. And but in the meantime, I would have put the check in the envelope, sealed it up, and put it in the post office.
And did they generally know how much they were expected to be paid? I mean, because it worked. I assume that depending on how many hours or whatever,
yeah,
did they keep track of
their
had
time? A sense. They had a sense of that. I don't ever remember. I need to back up just a little bit. A term that they would often use was gente humilde. We're humble people.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than saying we're poor, we're humble people. And it's an expression well understood. And it would be very rare to find a bracero that would argue. Their deportment was often very deferential. Come into the house, the hat came off. Not a lot of eye contact. A lot of nodding. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that probably helped, because I was a kid, and as I spent more time with them, then we didn't have that
barrier.
That's right. And I could, although at times I know I butchered the Spanish. One day I was down there and they were making tortillas, and so they started giving me a spelling lesson. And I had learned everything just from ear. And I don't think Fabian knew how to spell. He could barely write his name. And they would say, Chihuahua. And I would put W's and things in there, and they'd laugh. The younger ones would laugh, so the older ones would just kind of... But again, that gente humilde, the very kind of great deference, and my mom, we had some apple trees and stuff, and she'd make a pie or something and take it down. And they'd bring the dish back, and you're bringing back some interesting memories to me.
Sort of curious, did they ever go to town, to go drinking or see movies? Or
there was a pool hall a mile and a half from our place, and I don't ever remember a problem, but I remember a couple times on Saturday they'd walk down there, spend a little time, and come back. I do not know how comfortable they felt always with the resident population, Hispanic population. I do remember that Fabian's nephew one time came by, and I think he brought some beer or something, and they sat around and had some beers and things. But the focus on work just...
So it wasn't a nightly visit to the pool hall
no,
or anything
no,
like that?
No. I remember one case, and one only out of a number of years of having 5 to 6 braceros, where one fellow had borrowed a little bit of money from Dad, and he told me, he said, tell him I'll pay him on this day. And it was not until we came down where they're going to get on the bus, and... They'd had their shopping trip before that. They wanted to go shopping a couple times before they went back to buy things. And Dad said, tell Roberto that he still owes me you know, $10 or something. Mm-hmm. And when I approached him, it was like he was kind of squatting against the wall, and he saw me coming. And when I mentioned that, he just kind of went like that and got the money. He might have forgotten to pay, but the rest I found just number one, incredibly trustworthy,
mm-hmm.
especially given the situation where they're in a different culture, a different country. If they could do something for you, I mean, one time I lost a cultivator tool off the back of the tractor. In other words, I got the end and it had worked loose, and this is a big field, and I went over and said, could you help me look for this? And we spread out, went through and found the cultivator. No. And they didn't expect to be paid for that.
Hmm.
We had a good time.
That's really
and,
nice.
You know, I can't speak for them. I think that I know that there were some farmers. I mentioned in this particular thing that one time a neighboring farmer came to get me. He said, I told them what they need to do, but I just thought, you know, maybe you'd want to. And he was the kind that if you put an A or an O on the end of whatever English term, then that makes it Spanish, and he had told them things. And as we started talking, his tone and his method was kind of condescending, and it was, you know, my Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon I said, ¿Qué piensa de ese payaso? What do you think about this clown? And their first reaction was, I said, es un bobo, eh? He's a real clown, huh? And a couple of them said, yeah. And then when they realized that he couldn't understand any of that, they offered these gentle little assessments of his character. And we left, everyone feeling better, including the farmer who did not have a clue.
As he was the butt of the joke.
Didn't have a clue.
Do you think he was the norm, your dad was the norm, or was there no norm?
I believe that in our area, the nationals, I'm using that term, as a group, had a very positive reputation for hard work and for being on the job, for not causing any problems. And I believe that when the call came that, you know, the nationals are here, there was, I don't know if it was relief, but there was kind of a welcome in this regard. I mean, the beets were considered perhaps the best cash crop.
Hmm.
But since you couldn't grow lots and lots of acres of them because they were labor intensive, they still became a very important part of your crop year. And because many other things...
you could just hire more braceros?
You know, I think you could probably get more braceros, depending upon how many acres you planted. But then the company had some control over how many acres would be in the region because... Right. You have to accommodate them with the factory and its capacity and market conditions and things. But no, I believe that relationship was a positive one. I'm sure that there were farmers that didn't pay them as much as they should have, or that were, you know, they treated them as nothing more than what the name means, sets of arms.
Right.
But when farmers would come and ask me, can you come and we want to do this, and would you tell them? And those are opportunities to say, in a limited area around there, how are things going, and do you need anything? And some farmers would come and say, would you please ask them when they need to go to town, what they need, if things are all right. There was a desire to have, I think, content, satisfied labor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's self-serving, but it's, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, did they mix at all with the sort of Anglo society of church or...
Almost not.
theaters or anything?
For example, they're here 3 months, and if it works out that they can work 7 days a week or six and a half, and that translates into more money taken home, sent home. Yeah.
So they didn't take Sunday off, no matter if there was
not if they could work. Not if they could work. Huh. No.
Huh. You mentioned earlier that there was sort of alluded to a little bit of tension with the established Mexican American communities.
Sure, because there was the sense that, I don't know if tension is the right word, but just a little distance. These are people who have lived here for a time. They may, I never heard it, but I can sense at times that, well, the bracero supplies labor that we otherwise might have supplied. There's the old issue of undercutting wages.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I believe I do speak correctly when I say that most of the farmers I knew, if given the option of, again, five or six male workers here on a contract for a particular period of time, and a family or two who live here and have a car and have been here for a time, and I mean, in some cases, clearly, the women were probably as good or better than the men at. They're more careful about hoeing and thinning. But then you have kids from different ages, and they're working in the fields. And one story about the care that they gave occurred very curiously. I was driving down the end of, drive down the kind of road along the end of our farm, and I looked out, and it was interesting because they were not at the end of the field, but a little distance up there. I know they had long-handled hose because they're all standing, leaning on the hose, right, talking about something. And as I drove by, suddenly one of the men took his hoe and threw it in the air and jumped on it, and they were rolling around in the field and fighting. And I stopped the pickup, and I went up there. And by the time I got there, they had stopped everything. And then one explained, he said, when we thinned these beets, he said, I did a really good job. And I made very sure that if there are any weeds, I got them all out. Now when we're coming back to hoe, I want to do my rows. But he wants to do my rows because he didn't do a good job. And now he thinks if he gets my row, there are fewer weeds. And he wants me to... Está sucio. It's dirty with weeds where he... Because they would go through together. And whether or not he knew his rows, that was his statement.
Interesting.
And so the care there, but they were often interested in the livestock.
Mm-hmm.
They would ask, where are the horses? And I would say, can't eat a horse, we keep cattle. He said, no, you should have a horse, you know, to ride on. My mom would have a garden always, and give them some things from the garden. They would never ask for them.
Hmm.
Again, that gente humilde, that I'm here to work, I'm here to basically, you know, do what I'm told.
Did they have any kind of social life? I mean, certainly liaisons with women, liaisons between men, whatever.
On one occasion, Chuy, who was Fabian's nephew, brought one or two women by. And I know, I think my father was very upset with that. But social life? Buy a radio when you're here and listen to the radio. If the farmer hasn't supplied one, I do mention in there that when we go to town shopping, I understood some of their purchases. Sewing machines. Small, portable, hand-operated sewing machines were a hot item. We'd go secondhand store looking for those. But when they said, I want to buy a radio called ocho pilas, transistors, batteries.
Huh.
And I remember one time I thought, this guy has worked so hard and he's buying a radio. So I understood. It's my radio. And a couple days later, I saw the radio at the end of the field, wrapped in towels, and all you could see was the dial. And you'd hear him play it a little bit at night. And then he explained. So when I go home, there's no electricity where I live. I've got this radio. He said, the radio, you know, allows me to hear news and music. And then I can use the radio to have a dance at my house. And maybe my wife makes something to eat and sell it. And it was an economic transit. Actually, it wasn't recreational. And they would, I don't know how many times we'd go and they would want good radios. And they'd buy a radio. We did have to talk a little bit about cultural practices. Yeah. El precio está fijo. The price is fixed. No haggling. But there are other stores where they could. And yeah.
Yeah. So did they go shopping throughout their 2 or 3 months here, or did they just shop in the end?
When they would start out, we'd get groceries. And they'd go back if they needed groceries, or sometimes they'd ask me to get something. They would have sent most of their money, except what they wanted for groceries, home. Mm-hmm. And then toward the end, when they knew that the contract period was up, we would take a day, so, and they would have kept some of their money back, and we'd go shopping before their trip back home.
Closer to the end.
Yeah.
And so beyond things like radios and sewing machines, what were the other?
One came items? To me one day, and I thought this highly ironic. He said, can you get me some good corn seed? And I thought, you come from the land that domesticated corn, and you want good corn seed, but he did. And we got some corn seed for him. Guns. The purchase and ownership of sidearms in Mexico is very restricted. And I don't know how many times they would say, I want to buy a 38. I want to buy a... and, you know, I didn't really want to get that involved in that, and the guns were very expensive. But on one occasion, this is what I said that I knew. I saw him getting ready to go get on the bus, and he came up to me and he said, "Toca mi espalda, touch my back." What? Touch my back? Yeah, I'm a teenager. He said, "Toca." And I touched it. There was something hard there. He had bought. Let's see if I can remember what it was. A semi-automatic, I think it was a 32, maybe a 380, anyway, the caliber. He had disassembled it as far as he could. He had, in one boot, he had the handles. He had the clip in another boot. And then he had tied the frame with strings in the middle of his back. And he explained to me, he said, when you get to the border, they search you. On the Mexican side, they search you. And he said, they always search you like this and never in your back.
Wow.
And the other thing, the other cultural thing he said was, if I had a small something I wanted to smuggle, I would put it here because he's not going to touch me.
So he would stuff it down his pants. So.
Exactly. Put it near, you know, right. Near his privates. And he said, no one's going to touch me there. But this was too big. It wouldn't fit right there. But they asked me a number of times that. I mentioned in there the one I saw, the bracero, was not on our farm, and I had not known him, but I heard the argument when I came to bring them in, had purchased a windmill.
A windmill?
Had disassembled it. And while the bus driver was in getting his list of passengers, etc.,
right.
They had opened the back of the bus, and it's like an old school bus. And they're putting these angle iron legs in. The fan on this thing is 7 feet across. When I left, they were still arguing. The bus driver and the bracero, and he's going to take it home. And no, you're not. And I don't know whatever happened to that windmill. But with some of his earnings, because windmills were basically, if it was a farm and you didn't have any livestock, then the windmill was of no use. And this guy used part of his wage to buy a windmill.
Wow. Now, did they buy clothing also?
They would buy some clothing, not a lot. They might buy a pair of boots, etc. But I suspect that they found the prices kind of high. Mm-hmm. You know, I do not recall them buying gifts and things like that. But I do recall the corn seed. I recall the radios, the sewing machine. So that was the number one item. And we would go place to place, and they would say, "Quiero un Singer, Singer." Okay. And if they didn't have a Singer, that was basically hand-operated table model.
Right.
A white might do. But they had brands in mind.
Huh.
And someone said that Singer is almost next to Coca-Cola in terms of a trade name for its global extent, Singer sewing machines.
Huh. That's an amazing marketing story. Do you have a sense of whether they were writing, during their stay, whether they were writing home much, or was it just sending the pay?
No. They were writing letters, so there might be, I don't know how to even estimate this, but for every letter that went home with a money order in it, there were probably several others that went home just news.
Just news. Yeah. And did they receive mail also?
Very rarely. Very rarely. I don't remember getting letters for them very often at all. No. Yeah.
Now, sort of interesting, sort of some of the government aspects of things. Do you have any sense of, did anybody ever come out to inspect the farm, or did people show up to see how they were doing?
I never saw a person. I never saw an inspector.
I mean, that's been my sense in talking to people, is that if there were issues, the braceros were reported to the consulate, but that it was not.
Yeah. But,
like inspectors,
and then only on their way home, probably. Yeah. You know, and then.
Or lived with it, like the fellow that, you know, poor guy who was assigned to the clown.
Yeah.
Now, did you really were you just assigned people, or when you went down to pick them up, did you actually get to say
No.
It had already been preordained.
Yeah. Collins, 5, 6, and you go up and they'd be there. 1 year, I think we had 6. And when I looked at them, I thought, this is interesting, because 4 always stay together and 2 stay together. And the 4 I would talk to, and I believe they're from Jalisco. One of the things I remember, I took one of them to the barber shop, and he got in the chair, and the first thing he did was, "No le deje cortarme, okay? Don't let him cut my sideburns."
Huh.
He put his hands on them, and these guys were tall, you know?
Huh.
And the other two were like this. And sometimes I would hear the others talking, I couldn't understand a word, and I gathered that they were from Oaxaca, and they were Indian. And they would talk a little bit back and forth, but they would prepare their food separately, etc. They didn't have any differences, except that you kind of see them looking out of the corner of their eye at each other, like, what'd they say? That was interesting.
Huh, that's very interesting. Do you think, was the food actually different?
No, just in terms of their preparation, I think, of the food.
The Walk-ins would prepare their food together.
And then the others would. Yeah, one stove and.
Now, did anybody ever get sick that you can remember? Did you have to take them to the doctor?
One fellow got a broken ankle and he had to be taken to the doctor. And one fellow.
How'd that happen?
He was riding on a tractor helping out. And got his foot against the... In fact, I was driving. He got his foot against there, and it just popped his ankle.
Ooh.
And they took him in and put a cast and everything on him. And fortunately, or unfortunately, it happened right at the end of the work period, but he went back with a cast.
With the cast.
Yeah. One time, someone was ill, and I remember my father took him to the doctor, and my mother, bless her heart, who's a worrier, she said, "Don't you use the toilet down there, because the doctor thought maybe it was a you know, and she had a hard time. Say, a male disease. I don't know if the guy had a venereal disease or not, but typically, very few trips to the doctor.
Yeah,
I don't know how they never told me every time they were feeling bad or good or whatever. Right. But it was just work and
a lot of work.
Now, would they elect somebody in their group to do the food preparation, or would they share food preparation?
Did share it. I wish you could have seen the assembly line making tortillas. I write about it in there. It was great. Yeah, they'd make those. And I don't know internally if there's someone who's a better cook than the others, but and the foods they would buy were interesting, the things that they would want to buy at the store.
What would they buy?
Lard, cooked with lard.
Right.
They would buy very little meat because it's very expensive, but they would buy flour, salt, beans, a few chilies to season things. They might buy some canned meat, something that was easy to, just open it up and cook it like that. I think the menu is fairly limited and pretty straightforward because we have a bunch of males cooking who probably were not accustomed to cooking on a continual basis.
Do you think most of them were married with families, or were they single guys?
I got the impression that with the letters and things, that quite a number were married. They had left family behind. Yeah.
And they still seemed, I mean, I've all heard stories about people ditching their wives, but I don't know if that's the isolated example or fairly common.
I do know for some undocumented, I've had a little bit of contact with undocumented, and the existence of two families is not unheard of.
One in Mexico and one in the U.S.
But that's a anecdotal example of just a couple of them. As far as what I said was, and we never had one disappear from the farm. Five or six came, five or six left. Now, in the process from there to Mexico, I don't know, and I'm sure that not all of the, in a given year, if we're talking about 400,000, I'm sure that not all 400,000 were repatriated.
Right.
But this area was kind of far from the border and things, so don't remember that issue.
How did your dad keep track of time? Did he have like a ledger book or something?
No. Which makes me believe that they probably were working by acre. But again, I cannot confirm that. I do not know. As he said, you should have paid attention. But I just remember that I would go and Dad would go with me. Gosh, I wish I could remember if it was hours. And then I'd get a piece of paper and we'd calculate either the number of acres or the number of hours times the rate and show them. And some would kind of look and say, yeah, that's okay. And others would examine it. Okay. Now, given their general demeanor, if they thought that it was a little short, I'm not sure they would have been verbal about it. I just get that sense.
They're humble folk.
Yeah. If you look at Mexican culture and the tradition of the patrón, the landowner,
right,
for whom you work, and not a person to be questioned. And so I guess they transferred some of that in their behavior. In stores and things, they would never, that's why Dad would send me with them, I guess, they would never go up to a clerk and say, we'd go in as a group. And typically the clerk would come over and ask me, punk kid. And it asked me, what? One store we went into, my father was sitting there talking to the owner. Seven of us walked by. And the store owner was happy to have the business. We said to my father, that one national looks different. My father just said, nope, all beat workers. Later just chuckled and said, I've been out in the field, you know, and certainly dressed the same. And
what was the standard dress? And sort of you mentioned the hat.
Yeah, that was, you know, very early memory. But the straw hat was very common, and you could. I still maintain you can tell someone who has just come from Mexico because on the back of the straw hat, there's a little dangle that hangs about that far back from the. And I'm not sure the purpose of it, if it's a fly scare or what, but the straw hat, in some cases, huaraches, the sandals, the handmade sandals,
right.
Some cases, shoes, khaki or denim, something like that, basic, sturdy clothing.
And then they do their own laundry.
Yeah.
And then things like getting their haircut, they'd go into town for.
if they needed to, they'd go into town and get a haircut. But I have an adoptive Mexican brother. That's a different story. His relatives smuggled him into the country when he was a little kid, and then threatened to send him back, and they did. They tried to, and my father adopted him. So I guess they. So Manuel cuts hair. And we go down there. There's a day they're not working, and he's giving haircuts. And I know a few words of Spanish at this point. And interestingly, Manuel would almost refuse to speak any Spanish. I don't know if they experienced. Of course, by that time, he had been here for 14 years or something. And he's cutting. And I noticed just right by the guy's ear, a little tiny spot of blood. And so I use most of my vocabulary, and I say, sangre, blood. Obviously, like this, what you have. And then he saw us a little bit, and he sat back down, and Manuel faced the haircut. But Manuel would give him haircuts sometimes, or they'd give each other haircuts.
Huh.
Yeah. And they, my mother used to give me haircuts. And so we had equipment. Yeah. Need some scissors? Yeah.
Hey, my sister-in-law still gives me haircuts.
Hey, at the price, I envy you.
Were there any other obligations at the end of the contract? You had they had to get you had to get them back to the bus to
Get them there in time for them to get their stuff loaded on.
And again, was that something that the Great Western
we knew the
dictated?
Schedule? Yeah. They said at this time the their contract is up and their ride will be leaving at this time. The bus will be here at this time. Yeah.
What did you? In your situation, did contracts ever get renewed, or were they up for a contract that was the period that you really needed?
The contract was for the summer, so there was no renewal that I'm aware of. Yeah, it was.
And did you guys loan braceros out to, like if you didn't have work but somebody else would people go and work on other farms, or was it pretty much always on your farm?
It seems to me that essentially they were always busy on our place. Because 200 acres, there's always something else you can do. Should they have all the beets done and there's no bean weeding left to do or hay stacking, I do not recall any loaning or borrowing, but in some cases they might help us. I did a lot of irrigation. Setting the tubes and things, and that some of them would be anxious to lend a hand with that. They might not know a lot about the way we did it, but they were very good observers of what was going on. They watched and learned very well. I don't ever recall after the initial, and some had already done beets, and you'd ask them, and they'd say, yeah, I know what this is. And others, if they hadn't told each other, you'd tell them, just take the hoe and show them what you want done. I didn't see a problem.
And you provided all the tools, right?
Yeah.
So they really come with clothes, and that's about it.
That's all they had, yeah, clothes. Yeah.
Now, were there any days off? I mean, Saint Days or, Cinco de Mayo or something like that?
They never took a day off unless it was rainy or unless they absolutely needed to go to town.
Right.
So, I mean, socially, culturally, this is pretty isolating. Now, there was a farmer just across the road. There was one down the road. And I'm sure at times that they probably chatted back and forth and talked back and forth. But in terms of any kind of organized social No.
I just have a couple last, couple sort of broad kind of reflective questions. I mean, this is just, I have to say, this is really rich memories. You have really outstanding memories of this. During the Bracero period, on your dad's farm, was it strictly the Bracero workers, or did he ever mix crews with... Well, you said that
well, Fabian was there, yeah.
Well, he was the manager.
Oh, Fabian was mainly the tractor operator.
Mm-hmm.
It got to the point where my oldest brother married and was gone. My other brother died, and so it's my father, myself, and Fabian doing the irrigation, doing the tractor work, and then the Braceros doing the thinning and the hoeing, and occasionally helping out in those things. In some cases, they wanted to see how something was done, you know, or how we fed livestock. It just seemed to me that they probably took some ideas back, too, whether they were able to implement them. But mixing, usually those five or six working 7 days a week pretty well took care of all the hand labor that we needed done.
Now, after the end of the Bracero period, what did you do for labor?
Oh, after 62?
Yeah.
Local labor.
So,
of course, the other thing that's happening by this time, though, is that increasing mechanization. Beets, for example. I watch the neighbors now plant beets. They plant them. They cultivate them. They irrigate them. And they harvest them. There's no one in that field with a hoe. The new planters or the more recent planters, the monogerm seed, they're able to space that to the point where thinning probably is not economically rewarding. Selective herbicides instead of hoeing. No beet topping other than someone sitting in an air-conditioned cab and running through the field. What is happening in the area, though? Beets have always been important. But today, the demand for hand labor is more in cabbage, onions, and carrots. And those are crops that are increasing in their acreages here.
Mm-hmm.
And those require a lot of hand labor still. There's some things that have been difficult to mechanize.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, my perception is, that is almost entirely resident labor. Because I don't see the trucks, I don't see the Texas license plates, that spring migration much anymore.
Hmm. When did that migration phenomenon start to disappear?
By the late 50s, with the Braceros, it was less common. I would say, early 50s maybe.
We begin to, interesting.
The other thing is that Weld County and Greeley is currently experiencing a resurgence of migration from Mexico, both documented and undocumented,
mm-hmm.
as you're probably well aware. And I don't know how much of that migration is specifically geared to agriculture. I'm guessing that, I built a shed on my property to put junk in so the neighbors can't see it. And the crew that came in and poured the concrete floor. No native English speakers in the group. I couldn't separate resident from itinerant or recent arrivals, but as one of the guys finishing up there and we're sharing a cold drink, he said, yeah. If you have any more work, you know, anyone has any more work, he said. I haven't been here very long. I need work. And, so construction may be more lucrative than the seasonal, because of seasonality. And the nature of the work may be more lucrative than picking onions.
Do you think there are a lot of undocumented during the Bracero period, or do you think that's a more recent phenomenon?
In my personal perception, it's more recent. But when I look at the statistics, I see the Bracero flow, and then I see a simultaneous undocumented flow, because my reading is that there were always more applicants than there were slots.
Right.
And that also allowed some people to charge.
Right.
Others
it may not have been in this area. It's not clear what the distribution of undocumented workers is. But, well, I mean, 1954 is Operation Wetback. So there's a real push to stop illegal immigration.
But then the Korean War is over, and we have people coming back, and suddenly we have a glut of labor. So the U.S. government's done that time and time again.
Yeah.
You know, look the other way if you need labor, and become vigilant if you don't.
What do you think ended the program? Do you think it was mechanization just took away the need for the handwork?
In this area, I believe that was a lot of it, except, well, that timing's very interesting, because on our farm we began to use a beet topper, and we began to need less probably by the... I graduated from high school in 1960, so... it was becoming somewhat less, although we used braceros up as long as the program was in effect. And the significant increase of onions and cabbage and carrots did not occur at that time. That's been more recent. I would guess that for some of the vegetable farmers, prospects of a bracero-like program would probably be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, whether you want to call it captive labor, but in a sense, it's focused upon a time period and a job, and there aren't many distractions in that kind of situation. I mean, you ask about social things. Well, it was work. You ask about other things. No. So that was, for the farmer, almost ideal.
But it does seem to be a win-win that the braceros, I mean, it was, they didn't have a lot of cash opportunities in Mexico.
One of the young braceros was helping me. I know, I was building some fence, and he wasn't busy standing here when he was helping me, and we were talking. He said, I really worked hard there, and I bought a truck, and I was hauling stuff, and he said, I burned the engine up, and there's no way that I could earn enough money to buy an engine without coming here.
Huh.
And so he said, I came here, and all this money, I'm going to put a new engine in that truck. And as we were working, he's holding something, and I looked at his hand, and he's got a couple of fingers like that. And I said, what happened? He said, I was working, and a guy in Mexico hit me with a sledgehammer. And he said, these fingers just don't work anymore. And he said, no insurance, nothing like that, just tough it out. So it was win-win in that regard. Yeah. I wish the houses had been nicer. I wish the pay had been higher, et cetera, et cetera. But that kind of reciprocal advantage, a cash income, working at something that I know how to do, and the farmer saying, oh, yeah, a reliable labor source. That's the way the neighbors, I think, really perceived it. Even the Bayaso, even the Bobo, understood. What are you going to do with those beets if you don't have someone to work them? Eat them? Huh? Yeah. So it was mutually advantageous. But I know, for example, at one point they would not allow braceros into Texas because of the mistreatment.
Yeah, Texas was bad.
Yeah.
And this has been great. Is there anything that I haven't asked you or something that you want to say?
No, I don't think so. I just appreciate you dredging up some good memories.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. Do you have any photographs of your farm?